very short, because we're up next, the mysterious bacterial world in your gut. Believe it or not, yes, your guts are filled with bacteria, some good, some bad. They help you digest your food and fight disease, but they can also give you a bad tummy ache or worse. And there is a lot of bacteria in your gut, and now that dark world has just gotten a little less mysterious. Using new techniques developed to catalog the life in soil or in the ocean, researchers have found that our guts are much more diverse than they once thought they were. They've also found that the community of bacteria living in our guts is quite susceptible to a common antibiotic. Joining me now to talk about this is David Relman, professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's also chief of infectious diseases at Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Relman.
It's a pleasure.
Were you surprised by all of this?
I was a bit, yeah. I think we all knew that there were probably many more folks or friends down there than we thought, but the numbers keep growing.
And how I was reading that there are a few pounds of bacteria bugs in our guts.
Yeah, at least a few pounds. And maybe even more sobering is the fact that we're essentially 10 parts microbe, one part human. We have 10 times as many microbial cells in us as we have human cells.
Wow. And so if you add all the people up, how diverse is the colony of bugs in our guts?
Well, we're still trying to figure it out. It looks as though, at least at the distal ends of our gut, down in the colon, we're talking at least a few thousand different strains and species in each of us. And the amazing thing is that each of us is a bit distinct and different from each other.
How do you go about studying all these different species of bacteria and stuff?
Well, historically, it's been largely dependent upon cultivation, growing the bugs in the lab, looking at them and trying to distinguish who they are and what they do. Well, it turns out that cultivation is really not a terribly sensitive method, and we miss almost all of what's actually there just because we don't know how to grow it in the lab. So now we're using sequencing and efforts to pull out bits of sequence DNA and look at the DNA sequence information and say, aha, these are the organisms that must be there because their sequences tell us that that's who they are.
Mm-hmm. And what functions do all these bugs do in our gut?
Well, this is maybe the thing that's a bit surprising to many, and that is they're really providing essential beneficial functions. They're teaching our immune system what to recognize as foreign and foe and what to recognize as friendly. They're helping the development of our gut. They're providing essential nutrition functions, the ability to break down plant material, for example, and absorb calories and nutrients from these complex foods. And finally, they're also protecting us from invasion by disease-causing organisms.
Mm-hmm. Talking with David Relman on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. He's author of a paper that's being published, I guess, this week in the journal Public Library of Science Biology about the guts that live in our gut, the bacteria that live in our guts. What do they do to the immune system? What kind of they attack? Because the guts are considered to be outside the body, right?
Well, it's a bit of a sort of in-between world. The intestinal microbiota, as we refer to it, the bacteria that normally live there, are being constantly sensed by our immune system. And through that sensing, these bacteria, which are there from birth and live with us until death, are basically teaching and instructing our immune system to be constantly on the guard and to also maintain the boundary between us and them. It's an essential beneficial function they're providing. And through that, our immune system then learns when and how to respond when an untoward invader, a disease-causing bacterium, arrives and tries to enter, you know, the previously sacrosanct regions of the body.
You know, whenever we get an antibiotic, our doctors will tell us, watch out, it's going to really hurt you, you know, affect your digestive system. You did test a commonly used antibiotic.
That's right.
And what was it and what did you find?
We picked an antibiotic that we thought would be relatively benign compared to others. It's called ciprofloxacin. Received a lot of press because it was the antibiotic used to protect our postal workers who were at risk for exposure to anthrax back in 2001. And most of them did just fine without untoward side effects. But we know that this and other antibiotics can cause problems at the same time they're being used for, you know, obviously important purposes. Well, so what we did was we took some, so asked some human volunteers to take ciprofloxacin for just 5 days. And we collected their poop samples before and during and then well after the exposure. And the result was that something like a third of all the strains and species in the gut were profoundly affected.
Much higher than you expected.
Much higher than we thought. That's right.
One third.
One third. The good news, though, is that by about 4 weeks after exposure, the community had become restored. The numbers of the original organisms had returned, and the community looked more or less as it did before exposure.
Mm-hmm. Can you help restore the bacteria in your gut, the good bacteria, and maybe fight off the bad bacteria, overwhelm them a bit?
Great question. In fact, it's something that is quite on the minds of many people these days, because we'd love to know how to not only anticipate problems, but prevent problems. And, of course, one of the strategies, as you suggest, is the idea of deliberately ingesting live organisms that either may be a part of the normal healthy communities or will somehow prompt the community to maintain the proper numbers. Well, I think the answer is it makes sense, and it probably can be done, but I don't think we're smart enough right now to know exactly how best to do it.
All right, I'm going to hold your thought right there and talk more about this, because you know people are going to want to know what to buy in the store to do
exactly.
this.
Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after we take this short break and talk more about bacteria. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Dr. David Relman, professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford. We're talking about a paper published about what bacteria in your guts are like and what role they play. And I mentioned before we left, you know, a lot of people want to know how to replenish or put good bacteria back in. And I think Eugene in Kansas City I think I pushed the wrong button. Christine in San Francisco is on the phone. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. This is a great topic. A couple of months ago, I got a really bad case of pneumonia, and they gave me antibiotics, and my gut felt very different right after I got out of the hospital. So I started taking some yogurt preparations that they sell in the store,
right.
Because people were telling me you want to avoid getting other kind of infections. So I took them, but I want to also make sure, I mean, what other foods might help? Like with cheese?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Relman, can you replenish it yourself?
Well, that's a good question. It looks as though it may be possible. And of course, it would be the foods that have live cultures as part of them. So yogurt is really one of the most obvious, but you can also buy tablets, of course, that have live bacteria in them. I think the one danger is that you don't want to go overboard. As they say, moderation in all things. And
right.
I think once we have a better idea of which particular organisms have the greatest benefit for each individual, we'll have a much better idea of how to go about doing this.
Thanks for calling. Here's a question from Second Life from Captain Webby, who says, what is the difference between the E. coli in our stomachs and the E. coli that makes us sick? We keep hearing about food contaminated with E. coli.
Yeah, that's a great question. The difference is basically a handful of genes. They're brothers and sisters in the same family, and the disease-causing organisms have picked up a group of genes that encode toxins, for the most part, and also adherence factors. And it makes those E. coli very different in their behavior, although they're ancestry is very similar to those of the health-associated ones in your
mm-hmm.
gut.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we talk about the good bacteria versus the bad bacteria, I have been reading the literature over the years about the idea that may be in vogue with some doctors that if you can create a good colony, a very big colony of good bacteria, you can overwhelm and make yourself healthier the bad bacteria that might be in your gut. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think there are bits and pieces of truth there.
Mm-hmm.
And there is certainly the clear concept right now that by having a diverse and appropriate, whatever that means, appropriate community of bacteria in your gut, you can resist the invasion of a disease-causing organism. It's a bit like an apartment building that's populated by a bunch of families of diverse types, and all the rooms are full. It prevents squatters from coming in and taking over the space. If you obliterate the normal inhabitants and there's empty space, and now we're talking almost in ecological terms, then organisms that otherwise couldn't do this will now enter and grow to large number and do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
How much of what we start out as infants do we inherit from our parents around us and possibly from breastfeeding of the bacteria?
It's a good question. It looks as though a lot of the organisms that become a part of us in adulthood were acquired early in life and even right at birth. And although that first year of life is almost chaotic from the point of view of who's there in your gut, there's a clear indication that early on the major sources are from your mom and from your dad and from the immediate environment.
Let's go to Matt in Naples. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, I've taken the active yogurt when I was on antibiotics, and the thing that didn't make sense to me is how you can eat active cultures of bacteria, and they can make it all the way into your intestines, getting through your stomach environment and everything without dying. How does that work?
Well, it's an interesting question, too. It's probably the case that they succeed by just virtue of their numbers. Some of them do die on the way through, and stomach acid is one barrier for certain organisms, preventing them from making their way down to the lower reaches of your intestinal tract. But yogurt and other live culture preparations are loaded with literally billions and trillions of organisms, and the idea is that enough make it through to reach favorable habitats, and they will then propagate.
It seems like from the questions you're raising and the research you've published and how surprising some of the results are, that you still have a long way to go to know what's happening in there.
Yeah, it's
humbling. Deep, dark, it's humbling.
It's humbling. You would think that at this point in our history, you know, scientific and intellectual history, that we'd have a better idea of who we are. But the funny reality is that we almost know more about the jungles of the tropical rainforest in terms of their diversity than we know about the diversity within our intestinal tract.
Why would it be so diverse? I mean, are there just so many sources that are coming in that we're exposed to every day of our life? And
well,
we pick
again,
these things up?
I think a large amount of the diversity is picked up very early on, and it's maintained and allowed and even selected for because it's an intrinsic part of who we have evolved to be as living beings. It's not an accident. We need those communities. And they need us.
Right. I would imagine there's a lot of jostling and survival of the fittest in there going on.
Oh, absolutely. But there's also incredible altruism. These organisms will self-sacrifice left and right for each other and indirectly for us as the host.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one kind of bacterium will feed another. One will die in large number just so that a rare mutant can arise and fill a niche and provide a function that the others didn't have. There's just a lot of altruistic behavior among bacteria as well as, self-serving behavior as well.
We've talked a bit with other experts who look at bacteria in the soil, and they tell us, 90% of the bacteria you can't grow in a Petri dish,
which
is shocking itself,
That's right. That's right. In fact, when we began this work, our assumption on the one hand was that maybe this story would be the same, that just a teeny fraction would be recognizable as having been cultured before. Clinicians, on the other hand, said, oh, no, it's going to be different in there, meaning in our body, because hundreds of years of effort and much more familiar conditions will have led to successful cultivation. And the answer is someplace in between, that right now about half or maybe a little bit less of what we find using these molecular tools are organisms that we had never seen before, haven't yet been cultured, and are essentially novel.
And give us an idea of exactly what you do there.
We take specimens from the body as best we can, and we extract DNA, and then we sequence the DNA. And we look for the sequences that we can recognize as bacterial, and from those sequences, basically recreate an evolutionary tree and ask, well, what are the branches? Who's there? Mm-hmm. What are they closely related to? Can we name them based on sequences we've seen before? And if not, who are their relatives?
Is it possible to have sort of a DNA fingerprint, a bacterial fingerprint of a person?
You know, it's funny you ask, because there are many people now who are wondering whether there's a new kind of biometric that could derive from our intestinal, but maybe even our oral microbiota. And this would be a biometric that not only says who that person is genetically, but also says who that person is in terms of their recent life experiences, where they've been living, what they do, who their pets are, with whom they spend time. And I think that's an important and open question. There may well be some signatures in mm-hmm. our microbiota that can tell others who we are as people and as you know, life forms on the planet.
Could they also tell who our family members are? Because we start
yes.
out with the
same. And in fact, recent work by Jeff Gordon and others has suggested that the more closely related you are genetically, the more similar will be your microbiota.
Hmm. And so what's the holy grail for you as someone who studies these bacteria?
Well, I think probably two bits. One is what's the nature of variation within these communities from one site to another, at one site over time, and between individuals? And then the second bit is what are these organisms really doing, and what are those functions that are mm-hmm. intrinsic to serving in a symbiotic role with us? What is it exactly that they do for us, and what do we do for them, and how can we, you know, optimize and maximize those activities?
Mm-hmm. It's a kind of research we don't ever think anybody's interested in.
Well, and it hasn't exactly been a popular funding topic until recently, and I have to say,
yeah.
NIH and now a lot of nations around the world have suddenly jumped on this idea of trying to define who we are from this particular perspective.
And where do you get your funding from?
NIH right now has a big initiative called the Human Microbiome Project. And then private foundations have found this an area that has been under-explored and worthy of support.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Relman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your interest.
You're welcome. David Relman, Professor of Medicine and Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Veterans Affairs in Palo Alto Healthcare System.